Chairman Ankeny?
Here.
Vice Chair Connell?
Here.
Vice Chair Wolken?
Here.
Senator Barrett?
Here.
Senator Blaisdell?
Here.
Senator Malik? Senator Kerry?
Here.
Senator McNally?
Here.
Senator Regeer?
Here.
Senator Richmond? Senator Small?
Here.
Senator Temple?
Yes.
Senator Vukovich?
Here.
Few reminders before we get rolling here. Silence your cell phones. If you're going to give testimony, please sign in. Of course, everybody knows your testimony is public record. We're going to do 93 and 101 in numerical order. Senator Richmond.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Richmond. I represent Senate District 28 in Yellowstone County. And today I bring you Senate Bill number 93, which provides for some new notice requirements for oil and gas drilling to certain property owners that are near to a well site. As preparation for this expedition today, I looked at some details from the 2007 session. And in Senate Bill number 19 that was introduced by Senator Shockley and Senator McGee at the request of the EQC, back in 2005 through 2007, there was a split estates committee that met as part of the EQC. And I took great interest in that committee, not necessarily because it affected my job, but because I ended up paying for it through my budget. So I had to watch them to make sure my money was well spent. After a number of months and a number of meetings around the state, Senate Bill 19 was introduced, and it changed the existing notice statute, which is in Title 82, Chapter 10. You can see my bill changes Part 502. And 503. So the original notice statute was developed in 1981 or 82, as I recall. It provided to notice to the surface owner of a well site in writing. It required a 10-day minimum notice and a 90-day maximum notice. The split estate committee chose to change that to a 20-day minimum notice and a 180-day maximum notice under this title. At the time the original notice statute was developed, I think every well in the state was a vertical well, at least from the surface down. The state conservation laws require certain setbacks from property lines for conservation purposes, and that varies depending on the depth of the well, but it goes from about 330 feet to about 990 feet for a gas well. And so at the time it was developed, using the surface location of a particular spacing unit was a good way to do notice. It noticed the landowner where the well was going to be, and you knew about how far from the property boundaries the well would be. These days we have a lot of horizontal wells. The surface location is has a lot of flexibility, and it can be much closer to the property boundaries than was initially anticipated. And so my proposal here is to notice people who live in the area of the potential for a well to be drilled that could be within 660 feet of their residence, of their dwelling. And so I think that's a reasonable distance. It's an eighth of a mile, a little over 2 football fields. Gives people an opportunity to review the effect that a well might have on their property. I do want to mention a couple of things because notice can get kind of complicated. So this notice is a statutory notice to the surface owner, and if you pass my bill, it would be also be to owners of occupied dwellings within 660 feet of the surface location. There are other notice requirements. In order to approve a permit to drill, the Board of Oil and Gas requires that there be a survey plat by a Montana licensed surveyor that shows the location of the well, located by the boundaries of the land. And so there is a notice requirement in Title 70, Chapter 16, Part 111, Montana Code's annotated, that requires the surveyor to give notice before entering on the land to survey a well site. So that notice exists independent of any notice that the Oil and Gas Board does or that this statute might require. In addition, as a result of a settlement of a lawsuit, not so much on the notice statutes, but on the right to participate, the Board of Oil and Gas requires that there be published notice of drilling permits in undeveloped areas, rural areas, for example, wildcats, as we call them. And that publication has to be made in the county record newspaper and in the Helena Independent Record. And it has to be published at least 10 days before the permit is approved. So that's a separate published notice to basically everyone. That notice, that requirement, allows for people to protest a drilling permit, the issuance of a permit. So the public notice provides for a protested permit. The statutory notice is to either the landowner or, in the case of my bill, to a resident within the 660-foot radius of the surface location. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand aside and let others speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there proponents?
Chairman Ankeny, members of the committee, for the record, I am Alan Olson. I am the executive director of the Montana Petroleum Association, and we are standing up here enthusiastically supporting Senator Richmond's bill that he has here before you today. Mr. Chairman, a little bit of history on this and how this came about. Over the last, I've been told it's been well over a year, the Board of Oil and Gas has been looking at various rulemakings. It started out following the last session when the legislature turned down the proposal to require setbacks from inhabitable property. And when the maps were drawn, the effect that that was going to have, I think there was very little space left in Montana where you would have been able to probably drill an oil or gas well. That kind of morphed into rulemaking on notification of inhabited dwellings. We all know what dwellings are. It's a place where you lay your head at night. And as that rulemaking progressed, it kind of morphed a little bit more and turned into occupied structures, owners of occupied structures, with a notice going out to any owner of an occupied structure within 1,320 feet or a quarter of a mile. As Senator Richmond said, you go back a few years, anybody that permits a well outside of a delineated field has to put notice in a paper of general circulation where the permitted well is going to be drilled, and also in the Helena paper, which was all good and fine. And, you know, it gets a little expensive advertising and the legal notices in the Helena paper, but we do that on every well that's not drilled in a delineated field. I brought a proposal to the Board of Oil and Gas that take this rulemaking back down to inhabited dwellings at 660 feet. We felt that at 660 feet, those are the people that are most affected by moving in for drilling, completion, and production operations. When you look at well spacing units in Montana, any well that's less than 6,000 feet is drilled on 40-acre spacing. That's 1,320 feet square. So anybody that's going to be in that immediate area of the well, in that spacing unit, on a well that's less than 600 or 6,000 feet deep is going to get notified. Mr. Chairman, this took a lot of convincing on my part to get our members to agree with this. We still feel that legal notice in newspapers is sufficient. But at the same time, we also feel that people that are directly impacted by a proposed operation should also get notice. And this will give them the same notice that we give the surface owner. No more than 180 days before operations start, and no less than 20 days before operations start. And as I said, these are the people that will be most affected. You're going to hear testimony, I'm sure, that, well, this isn't how they do things in Wyoming. This isn't how they do things in North Dakota. And this isn't how we do things in Kansas. But, Mr. Chairman, this isn't Kansas. And we feel that the people that need to get notified are getting notified, and we would definitely appreciate a due pass on this piece of legislation. Mr. Chairman, I'd be available for questions.
Thank you. Further proponents? Further proponents? Are there opponents?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Adam Haight, spelled H-A-I-G-H-T. I represent the members of Northern Plains Resource Council. We're a grassroots conservation and family agriculture organization. And I stand here in opposition today because the proposed legislation undermines the rules that were just recently passed on the December 14th at the Board of Oil and Gas after about 20 months of compromise and public comments. You know, just to give a little bit more context as well, 2.5 years ago, our members went before the Board of Oil and Gas asking for setback requirements. The board instructed us to bring this to the legislature. We did so, and that bill was tabled in committee, and we were told that it's probably best to handle this at the Board of Oil and Gas. Brought it back to the Board of Oil and Gas, and at the time, because Montana does have pretty open availability in order to go before the Board of Oil and Gas, we negotiated and tried to find a compromise with them, and the public notification is something that we found as a suitable compromise instead of setback requirements. And over a 19 to 20 month period, we came up with rules that would require a quarter mile, and also it broadens it from the language that exists here. Instead of occupied dwellings, it also applies to occupied structures. So it goes beyond that. It also provides notification requirements for a school, a hospital, an office building. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, may I pass out the language of the rules that were just recently passed at the board, just so everyone has full context? And the primary differences I've been able to highlight there in terms of occupied dwelling, it's occupied structure, and the major difference. And just to let you know, there was a comment during this open process as to whether or not the board had the regulatory authority to do so. On the second to last page in that handout as well, you can see the back and forth and the four parts of Montana Code annotated that does give the board full authority to make these rule makings. And so essentially I just stand here and just ask that the lengthy process that's gone into this, the back and forth and the compromise that's taken place, that you let it stand. We've followed the direction from the legislature in order to make this happen at the Board of Oil and Gas. And I will say that I think what the board voted on is a Montana solution. Montanans were involved, and it involved landowners, it involved the industry, And I think we struck a compromise that we should live with, and that I think is going to allow folks that are going to be directly impacted, especially in rural Montana, in eastern Montana, where a lot of this development is taking place. Half the time, you just need to want to know what's going on, and reading the dailies is not going to happen all the time. And if you could just have a conversation with the company first to say that a well right here could disrupt my ag operation by X, Y, and Z, and if you could move it possibly here, or if that doesn't work, being able to go before the board and letting the board decide what's best. So with that, I'll sit down, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Durf Johnson. I'm here representing the Montana Environmental Information Center, and we do rise in opposition to SB 93. We would ask that you let the existing rules that came about through compromise and through a lot of different stakeholders and discussion, that you let those sit. 660 feet, an eighth of a mile, does not provide the same types of protections that a full half, a quarter mile would provide. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about people who want those protections, want to know potentially if their water supply is going to be compromised or if there's going to be some significant industrial activity next to their property. And we believe that a quarter mile is sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opposition?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brenda Lindleaf Hall. I am here on behalf of the Tongue River Water Users Association. The water users live and have agricultural operations and rely on water, groundwater, and surface waters in southeastern Montana. We did comment on this rule before the Board of Oil and Gas, and we, like the other opponents, believe that because of the length of time that was spent vetting this rule, the compromise that came about, that the rule that was put in place only so recently should stand. Those people deserve the protections, they deserve the notice, and they deserve the ability to be able to protect their water and their agricultural operations. Thank you.
Excuse me. Who do you represent?
The Tongue River Water Users Association.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further opponents. Further opponents, informational witnesses. Informational witnesses, seeing none, questions from the committee. Senator Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Barrett.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Richmond, I'm. Could you explain why, if you think it is appropriate and necessary to inform the owners of occupied dwellings, why wouldn't you also want to inform businesses or schools or hospitals or other property owners that might be similarly impacted?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Barrett, it's a practical matter. Most oil wells in our state are not drilled where there's a lot of businesses or other structures, shall we say, occupied structures are mostly drilled in the residential areas. My concern is that, like the surface owner of the well site, this is an individual that I am assuming is going to be living on the site, and therefore he's going to be present when the well is drilled, and he's going to be probably disturbed by the noise or maybe the lights or whatever. a business, you know, maybe open for a part of the day and closed. I don't see a drilling operation disturbing the functions of a business like it would, say, a residence with people that want to sleep at night and whatnot. So I think it's more important, at least it's more important to me, that the people that are there and exposed for 24 hours and are in the same elements, I guess, as the surface owner of a well site, those should be the people that are notified so they at least have some idea what's being proposed for their area.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
A hospital or a school?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Barrett, same thing with hospitals and schools. I'm not aware of any case where a well has been drilled close to a hospital, at least in Montana. I've lived in Oklahoma and seen them drilled in the backyard of a hospital there. I'm not aware of any case where a hospital is located in a place where an oil well is likely to be drilled. And pretty much the same for a school. We have a lot of rural schools. I guess what I'm going to say now is this is actual written notice to a person who lives on the property. There's a published notice and another notice by the surveyor. Those people, if they're interested in a hospital or a school or a business, have just as much right as any other resident of Montana to protest the issuance of a permit and ask the board to develop some kind of mitigation if it's within their jurisdiction to do so. So I think we're giving more notice, not less notice, by passing this bill.
Senator McNally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question for the sponsor. Mr. Chair and Senator, I wanted to follow up. I think to Senator Barrett's question, I do believe what you're proposing is more notice than currently exists, but it's certainly less notice than the rule from the Board of Oil and Gas.
Mr. Chairman, Senator McNally, it's a different notice, I guess, than what was approved by the board, a different distance and some different criteria, but it still is, I think, a step up from what the current statute requires. I'm a little sensitive to administrative rules changing or modifying an existing statute. The board has broad rulemaking authority under Chapter 11 of Title 82. It does not have broad rulemaking authority under Chapter 10. It has some specific rulemaking under another section that has to do with well plugging that's in Chapter 10. And so I think as a matter of policy, it is the legislature that should set the notice requirements. Since it has done that since 1982, and we should be careful not to let the administrative agencies of government change statutes or the meaning of statutes in order to reach a compromise on some issue.
Follow up? Mr. Chair and Senator, but it seems that the legislature has, in fact, in the past, asked the board to make the rules, and then now they've done that, and this would not even give that rule a chance. This is sort of the legislature coming back and saying the work that went into that, we can override.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator McNally, I think we are not simply rejecting all of the work that's done. We are decidedly broadening the scope of the notice. So I think that is part of the work that was done, was to raise our awareness that maybe there are other people that need actual written notice that may not, for whatever reason, know there's a well being drilled there. So I don't think we've entirely rejected the concept. I think we've tried to narrow the scope in my bill to who gets notice and try and limit it to the people who are likely to be the most affected by the operation. So I understand the concern about sending people back and forth between administrative agencies and the legislature. I've been there myself a few times. But in all reality, an administrative rule is adopted by an administrative agency under its rulemaking authority if it has such. It can issue exemptions to its own rule if it chooses. After notice and hearing, it could decide to waive the statutory notice. So I think this really firms up the notice. I think it really is a step more than was authorized before, because the legislature has established the policy, and I think that's where the policy making should be.
Follow up. Mr. Chair and Senator, I guess my other question, I understand that the Petroleum Association is in support. I was wondering who else was consulted as you worked on your bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McNally, I mostly consulted me, I think, and my experience and the experience dealing with the Split Estates Committee, who deliberately put this notice statute in Chapter 10, and who at the time thought about where to put a violation statute, and then chose, instead of putting the notice statute in Chapter 11 with the board's rulemaking authority, it would simply refer to Chapter 11 and make violation of Chapter 10 a violation of Chapter 11. So it was a fairly straightforward solution to an interesting problem. So I think the policy was made that the legislature chose to establish this policy for notification. I don't know who else was consulted in the board's rulemaking process. I guess maybe you could ask Mr. Olson who else participated, but I did not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Temple.
Mr. Chair, Senator Richmond, I got to commend you on the notification thing, but why did you go 66 feet rather than the quarter mile?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Temple, I chose 660 feet because it is a common distance for the spacing setbacks for vertical wells, and it is a established in practice, I guess, the 660 feet encompasses about 32 acres of notice, or if you're accustomed to 10 and 20 acre subdivisions, that's about 30 acres. If you go up to a quarter of a mile, of course, now you're up to over 120 acres encompassed within the area. So I'm not fixed on 660 feet. I just think that it is a common distance used in the board's rules already. It's an eighth of a mile, and I think it's a reasonable notice requirement. Since it's expanding notice, I thought it would be best to make that as compact an area as possible. We're not trying to be Paul Revere and spread the alarm here. We want to just make sure that people know if they're going to be affected. So that's how I got to 660 feet.
Senator Connell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, also for the sponsor. Mr. Chairman, Senator Richmond, we heard in testimony today, it seemed like there was a concern that this bill might abrogate either water quality for beneficial uses, or actually water rights under our prior appropriations doctrine. Would you care to address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Connell. You know, this is a notice of drilling operations, and so drilling and completion operations can take all sorts of forms. In Montana, we have had, to the best of my knowledge, no real impact on groundwater or surface water during the process of drilling a well. Now, we've had incidents or accidents that can happen from time to time. They're usually transportation accidents, frankly, that happen that might affect water quality. But the purpose of the notice is to let people know what's going to happen in the neighborhood. I don't see that it has a big impact on water quality or water use, certainly. There are all sets of rules, as you know, that affect water use, and people that drill wells need water, and they have to comply with those rules. So the notice, it really kind of stands alone. It's not really part, I don't think, of an environmental review process. It's just a notice process.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the clarification, Senator. I would suspect you would agree then that that would probably be the reason why that there was that neither DEQ nor DNRC was even present for this hearing as informational witnesses.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Connell, I think that this notice and the processes that the Board of Oil and Gas used to permit new oil and gas wells in the state are pretty well established, and all of the agencies of government, I suspect by now, are pretty familiar with them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, a question for Mr. Haight, please. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haight, you said that these rules had been propagated after about 20 months of hearings, and you talked about setbacks. I'm wondering about why, if other states require setbacks, and why did the board choose not to provide setbacks instead of just notice?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Malik, so Montana is a bit different in terms of who has the ability to come before the board. Typically, it's either, you know, just the surface owner where the well is going to be drilled, but Montana does allow folks to come in and request a hearing on a proposed well, even if you aren't the surface landowner. And that is why we kind of went down the notification route. We determined that, you know, Montanans do have the ability to go before the board. Let's just make sure that folks that can be directly impacted but aren't the surface owner where the proposed well is going to be located still deserve to be notified and have the chance to either work with the company or come before the board to express their concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a couple questions for the sponsor, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Malik.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Richmond, my first question has to do with, I looked at some of the citations that the Board of Oil and Gas says gives them the authority to propagate these rules. And one of the concerns is seismic testing. And so I'm wondering about when you're talking about that 660 feet, I'm thinking of saltwater ponds and seismic testing, and as you were saying, lights, and, you know, I mean, I don't know what the noise level is or what the, you know, the odors that are created or the saltwater ponds or the reintroduction of the water into the soil. I mean, what kind of impacts are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Malik, I need to right off the bat distinguish between seismic testing and well drilling. So seismic testing is typically done by a third-party contractor, and they use some mechanism to inject energy into the ground, either a vibrating truck. The old days it was dynamite, worked pretty good, and measure the returning sound. So lots of times seismic is done before wells are drilled, but seismic is typically not done while a well is being drilled. It's done before it in order to find the prospect to drill. So there's a separate section on seismic prospecting in Chapter 10. There's a separate notice requirement, actually, and a separate set of landowner obligations, shall we say, in Chapter 10 that have to do with seismic. So what's likely to happen with a drilling operation depends almost entirely on what what you're looking for and where you're looking for it. So in Montana, we have a number of very distinct geologic settings. Some wells are very shallow. Senator Temple is in an area with a lot of 1,400 to 2,000 foot gas wells. They're drilled with fresh water or air as a circulating medium, and they're typically drilled and completed in about 3 days. So you get over into the northeastern part of the state, there can be a number of different operations there. Everybody, I think, is probably at least accustomed to talking about Bakken wells. They're typically deep wells drilled down about 10,000 feet and then out maybe another 9 or 10 or even more thousand feet. Interestingly enough, it doesn't take very long to drill one of those wells either. So these days, drilling times have gotten to be less than 30 days for even a, say, an 18,000-foot drilled length Bakken well. Or drilling rig may only be there for less than a month. And then typically there's a completion rig that comes in and does other things for a period of time after that rig moves off. So, you know, what actually happens on a site depends entirely on what you're looking for and what you expect to do to complete the well.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Richmond, Senator Richmond, excuse me. Please pardon my ignorance about this, but in the drilling process then, is there, you know, what's the noise like? What's the odor like? What's in the actual process of drilling?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Malik, there's a level of noise that comes from the drilling rig, from the engines, that can be mitigated and typically is mitigated when you're close to a residence. There are better grade mufflers that can be used on the engines. There can be quiet periods during the night where people try not to do a lot of things. But frankly, the new technology is such that the rig typically is drilling and making actually very little noise because there's not a lot of pipe movement anymore. In the old days, if you wore out a bit, you had to pull every piece of pipe out, take the bit off, put a new bit on, and then run every piece of pipe back into the well. These days, the wells drill for a very long time on one bit. There's not a lot of pipe movement, so you know, basically, you have your generators running and your pumps running, and it's kind of a steady state noise. I can't say it's noise free, but it's not the kind of periodic increases in noise, the kind of annoying stuff that things squeaking and brakes squeaking and whatever. So the technology really has changed too. Odors are, you know, there's not a whole lot of anything that's used on that site that would have an odor. Most of them are drilled, at least the surface holes, drilled with water or a water-based drilling mud. And then the bottom hole is often drilled with a polymer-based drilling fluid that doesn't really have an odor.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, one more follow-up. Mr. Chairman, Senator Richmond, my last question has to do with the authority of the Board of Oil and Gas to promulgate these rules. And my concern is, for quite a while, quite a few years in Montana, we said growth plans don't matter. And I think that was a legislative action that said, well, we can zone however we want to in our communities. We don't care what the growth plan did. So we had people in Missoula participating in a two-year process similar to this, developing a growth plan, thinking it was going to be enforced, and they had to actually take the case to court, and we actually did determine that the growth plan does have legal authority over zoning. And I have to say that in this instance, I feel like the governmental entity closest to the people who have listened for 2 years to what they had to say and decided to come to a compromise and develop some rules should not be overridden by people from the other side of the state, basically, where I'm from, and enforce that on people in eastern Montana or central Montana. So I am concerned about overriding the authority of the Board of Oil and Gas, who have cited several statutes here that they say gives them the authority to promulgate these rules.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Malik, I think the authority to adopt administrative rules comes from the legislature. I don't think it comes from on high. And so the board was granted rulemaking authority for conservation rules in its chapter, in Chapter 11. And it is a very broad set of rulemaking. This is in a different chapter. This chapter set the policy for notice, not for conservation purposes, but just for notice purposes. So there's no conservation law involved in the notice statute in Chapter 10. The notices and the drilling permit processes in Chapter 11 are the conservation processes that the Oil and Gas Agency does. And so my concern is that the legislature sets the policy for notice. It set a policy. I'm proposing to broaden that policy, but I don't think the legislature should simply give rulemaking authority to an administrative agency without understanding what the purpose of that rulemaking is. And it has different purposes between Chapter 10 and Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is the conservation and operating requirements. Chapter 10 is the notice requirements.
Further questions? Further questions? Senator Richmond, would you like to close?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will not take this much longer than it's already gone on, but I think Senate Bill 93 recommends a change to the statute that broadens the scope of the notice. It recognizes a change in technology from the old days where vertical well setbacks were in fact a good way to notice the owners. They set certain standards for how far you had to be from a property boundary. New technology has allowed wells to be placed much closer to property boundaries without actually impinging on the property through horizontal drilling and directional drilling techniques. I think the statute should be modernized and broadened to recognize that there are people now that could be affected by, impacted by drilling operations that are close by that weren't considered back when this statute was originally developed. I believe the Split Estates Committee in 2007 appropriately changed, after a lot of public input, the requirements for notice. And I do not believe that we should set policy based on what administrative rules have been adopted, but rather on what the policies the legislature should choose to adopt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 93. Now, Senator, would you like to open on Senate Bill 101?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Richmond. I represent Senate District 28 in Yellowstone County. And today I bring you Senate Bill number 101, which proposes to repeal the ethanol mandate in Title 82, Chapter 15 of Montana Code, annotated. And because it is a repealer, Mr. Chairman, you can see it is a one-page bill. And so I have made some copies of the code sections being replaced, or repealed, excuse me. And with your permission, I'd like to pass those out. The ethanol mandate in Title 82 came about as a result of the adoption of the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard in 2005. response to concerns about nations' dependence on imported oil, Congress enacted the Renewable Fuel Standard Program as part of the Energy Policy Act of 2005. It required that a minimum of 4 billion gallons of biofuels be used in 2006, raising to 7.5 billion gallons by 2012. 2 years later, the Congress passed the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 and expanded the biofuel targets to 9 billion gallons in 2008, up to 36 billion gallons in 2022. Shortly after the Renewable Fuel Standard was passed, legislature passed the two code sections you see that I'm proposing to repeal and the one, of course, to be modified. These code sections set a trigger volume in Montana. They require a certain amount of denatured ethanol, denatured with gasoline, I guess, in Montana, 40 million gallons, and they require the executive to certify that there is 40 million gallons being produced. And when that happens, then, this ethanol mandate goes into effect. Well, there is no ethanol being produced in Montana, and there never has been. So you will see that these two code sections are marked temporary. They're temporary because they've never gone into effect. The triggers have never happened. So removing them from code doesn't change, unfortunately, I think, doesn't change whether or not we have ethanol in our gasoline. It takes a mandate out of our statute so that if the federal government chooses to change the renewable fuel standard somehow or another, we're not stuck with obsolete information in our statute that might lead people to believe that they should be blending anything in our gasoline other than what I think is gasoline. In the years since this standard was established, U.S. oil imports have decreased. In fact, the United States is now a net exporter of energy, oil and natural gas. At the same time production was growing, the consumption of gasoline was falling. You can attribute that to, you know, CAFE standards or whatever you might. So there are really three concerns expressed. I'm reading from a GAO report that was just published in November last year. So the concerns are compatibility. Ethanol blends higher than E10 degrade or damage some materials in underground storage tanks, which can lead to leaks. Because of the cost of over compatibility, the concerns over compatibility, new storage and dispensing equipment is required to sell stronger blends of ethanol at the cost of about $100,000 for an underground storage tanker and $20,000 for a compatible fuel dispenser or pump. And, of course, retailers are concerned about the liability, especially for older engines, because ethanol can and does damage older engines. I can also remark from personal experience that it's not very good on modern lawnmowers or snowblowers either. And I understand chainsaws don't like it particularly well. Jet skis. And, of course, when I started out down this line, somebody told me that we should never trust a society that would rather burn their whiskey than drink it. And so, with that, Mr. Chairman, I would propose to repeal the code sections from the statute that have no effect at the current time and probably will not in the future. And with that, I'll sit down and see if anybody jumps up here to testify.
Proponents.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Olson, representing the Montana Petroleum Association, and there is no way I could ever think about topping the senator's opening on this bill, so I'm just here to say me too.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Hello, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Brad Longcake, L-O-N-G-C-A-K-E, and I'm the executive director for the Montana Petroleum Marketers and Convenience Store Association. I represent retailers and distributors across the state, and we fully support this basically for the majority of the reasons that the senator referenced. So we are in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Hi, my name is David Herbst, Chairman Inke and members of the committee. I'm with Americans for Prosperity Montana. I'm their state director. We are Montana's largest free market policy nonprofit with a 14,500 Montana citizen leaders and an ever-expanding base of local donors. We're here concerned about the ethanol mandate. Specifically, while it creates a lot of problems, it doesn't solve really very many. And if the federal government were to overturn its rules on ethanol, we don't want Montana statute being in the way because it might be at some point where we can't get it out of the way for another 2 years, depending on the timing. So we were concerned about that and want to tell you just a little bit. If you're at all supportive of the ethanol mandate and want that in Montana statute, I just want to maybe address a few of those issues very quickly. Ethanol mandates do not help the environment. When you factor in land use changes, cutting down forests to plant corn, for example, ethanol might not actually reduce CO2 emissions. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan organization, concluded, quote, available evidence suggests that replacing gasoline with corn ethanol has only limited potential for reducing emissions, and some studies indicate that it could increase emissions. It also has an effect of increased fertilizer runoff. Friends of the Earth, who's not a group I'm used to quoting, says, quote, corn cultivation for ethanol also often involves large quantity of nitrogen fertilizer, which often runs off of cornfields, with adverse impacts on water quality and the environment. Maybe those trade-offs might be worth it, and I'd be willing to hear that argument, but it might be worth investigating to mitigate those sorts of effects if ethanol were actually effective as a fuel, but it's not. Ethanol has a lower energy content. The EPA concluded in a 2014 study, in general, vehicle fuel economy may decrease by about 3% when using E10 relative to gasoline that does not have fuel ethanol. And what that means is ethanol is 33% less energy potent than just gasoline. So by putting it in, we're literally making our cars slower, less fuel efficient. Lastly, the ethanol encourages an increased bifurcation of the American populace into a two-tiered society, something that my organization is really concerned about. We're concerned about keeping government small so that people can build their own American dream. And this is one of the barriers there, and I'll explain it as partially mentioned by the bill sponsor. As the committee might know, ethanol can harm some vehicles, as was mentioned, and equipment. Higher ethanol content is not approved for vehicles that are older than 2001, as it can cause damage. It's also damaging to power tools. What is often not discussed is that these programs, that they hurt the poor. The people who are more likely to own a car older than 2001 are poor folks. And in Montana, owning a car and having good fuel mileage on that car is critically important for getting groceries, to get into your job, or any of those things. So one of the criticisms of ethanol is that it takes land that would be used for food and directs that for fuel. This is a critical insight the supporters seem to miss. There is an opportunity cost for every acre of land that we have that can produce, you know, things that turn into biofuel. And diverting that away from food into fuel, when we have fuel in the ground that doesn't take up any space that could be used for something else, is, in my opinion, a waste. Lastly, the biggest push for ethanol was originally, along with what the sponsor said, is that we're going to run out of oil, and this is a great way to dilute the oil supply and make more of it. We're going to run out of gas to put in our cars. Well, the fracking revolution has taken care of that concern. It turns out, unintuitive as it may be, that the more energy intensive a civilization is, the more access to energy we get. So in summary, AFP Montana would recommend a do pass on Senate Bill 101. And for the ethanol repeal. If this bill does pass committee and gets to the Senate floor, we're letting folks know that we would be scoring for SB 101 on our scorecard to let our supporters know that this is something that's really important, notify them that it's coming out from committee so that they can get engaged in the process too. We try to let legislators know about our scoring process and to make that process completely transparent beforehand so you're not surprised after the bill's got to the floor that it's being scored. So thank you for this opportunity to testify. I'll be available for any questions.
Thank you. Further proponent.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Lee Sturdivant. That's S-T-U. That's S-T-U-R-D-E-V-A-N-T. I'm here representing myself. I remember very much when we started using ethanol, and I lived in Nebraska at the time, part of the military. I keep real good track of my mileage. I've always practiced mental math by trying to do all the math while I was driving. And so I did it for every tank of gas. When they first came out with ethanol, you had a 10% reduction in fuel mileage with ethanol versus regular gas. Since then, absolutely nothing has changed. A few years ago, former Senator Verdell Jackson tried the same test on his vehicles using an unethanoled fuel with alternating tanks back and forth because he had to come here to the Senate, and he still got 10% change when he used an unethanoled fuel. Just recently, I bought a new car, or it was a new car to me. 4 years old, it was an Audi, and it had a check engine light. Part of the agreement on buying that was that that got fixed. Well, guess what it was? The previous owner had been running ethanoled fuel, and that had destroyed the seals on all of the injectors, a mere $3,000 cost. Ethanol destroys all of those types of products in any car. It's just a matter of whether or not you want to measure it. It causes a lot of increased cost to both the consumer, and it really doesn't give us anything. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents? Proponents, are there opponents? Opponents. Informational witnesses. Informational witnesses. Just before you close, before you, or we get to questions, I'm just going to say one thing. You know, I don't care who it is, stands up in this committee and testifies. I don't want anybody telling me or this committee that they're doing a scorecard on them. If you're doing it in this committee, if you're doing one, that's fine. But I don't want that testimony given. Questions from the committee? I didn't say you couldn't ask any questions. Would you like to close?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. The one thing that I am a little sensitive to here is I don't want people to think if you pass this bill, ethanol will disappear from gasolines in Montana, because it won't. There are some legitimate reasons to put ethanol in gasoline. One of them is as an oxygenate for areas of our state that are in non-attainment status for air quality purposes. Oxygenated fuel is required. The one that I am aware of that is a year-long requirement is in Missoula. They require some oxygenated fuel, and of course ethanol works fine for that. It helps with the octane number, but I understand from visiting with some of the refinery people that they can create whatever octane they need from the molecules and hydrocarbons. They don't really need ethanol to increase octane. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just close and say I think these are some interesting statutes that were adopted a number of years ago. They've never been in full force and effect. I'm not too sure that we want them to be, and so I think we should repeal them and not leave them on the books to mislead people about the direction we'd like to take with ethanol gasoline. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Richmond. This closes the hearing on Senate Bill 101. Let's see. On Thursday, we will be doing executive action on Senate Bill 7, 32, and 12. So if there's nothing further, we will adjourn. This committee is adjourned. This committee is adjourned. Adjourned.